I want to say a few words about our theme. I really appreciate all of the scripture and the teaching that's happened so far. There's a line in the Charge of the Goddess that Ondine shared with us. I am the soul of nature that gives rise to the universe. And this is the presence that we are seeking to become more intimate with. And today we're talking about morality. And morality is, you know, even to say the word has a kind of top-down feel to it, almost like to even bring up morality almost feels like somebody's telling you you're doing something wrong. we have a few people in the room with us today, and they're all nodding their heads. But what I'd like to suggest is that morality is inherently natural, is in a sense part of our DNA, is not an artificial imposition in our lives. It is, you know, I was listening to our sister Anne Redding speak about this the other day. And she was saying, what is morality? And starting at the point of, well, morality is what's good. And of course, that's true. But the more I look at it, the more it seems to me that morality is really what's normal. It's how we act with each other. At this moment in time is acceptable to us as a people, as a species. And of course we could do better and we could do worse as individuals, but morality is just kind of that baseline of what we accept as normal. It's kind of like, I use this example a lot, but it's kind of like how traffic works. You know, we all manage to get by with traffic, and we don't all follow the laws to the letter, but everybody knows that you don't follow the laws to the letter. Nobody arrests you for going 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit. Everyone goes 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit. You know, that's morality. That's what's moral. Somewhat more serious example, we accept a certain number of traffic deaths, and quite a lot of traffic deaths. And, you know, there's things we could do about that. We could change the laws. We could change the speed limits. It would not be hard to reduce the number of traffic deaths by a considerable amount. But we, as a people, you know, we choose not to do that. That's a moral choice. Now, no one individual made that choice, but it's what we're working with. It's our baseline morality. So rather than an ideal of goodness that we are trying to achieve, I've come to look at morality as more like a sense of fitness that we are constantly working with. And when I say fitness, I don't mean like physically fit, or I mean fit like a puzzle piece, you know, that fits, you know, fitness like providing the perfect side dish for a potluck. You know, I think that's an inherently moral act. You know, for centuries in Europe, you could be hung for stealing a loaf of bread. And I'm fairly certain most people then would have thought that was, if not fitting, just the way things are. That's the way things work. You know, now we look at it and we feel like, no, that just doesn't fit. You know, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. And most of morality is really that sort of working things out in our hearts collectively. It's just how we treat each other as social beings. And we are nothing if we are not social beings. We are, one human being by itself is, you know, as insignificant as an ant. And as significant as Christ or the Buddha. That's just one of those paradoxes we swim in as human beings. But if you think about it, we are absolutely nothing without our ancestors, without everything that this is built on. We owe everything of who we think we are to the people that came before us and the people who shaped us. There's an Arabic book written in the 12th century called Hay ibn Yaqzan, and it was the original Robinson Crusoe tale. It's probably where Defoe got the plot from, where a man is shipwrecked as a baby on an island and grows up completely alone and manages to reconstruct, using his rational capacity, all of human civilization. And this was actually translated in the 16th century into all the European languages and had a huge influence on humanism and the European Enlightenment. But this idea that rationality could take you the whole way. But it's simply not true. You know, feral children do not become philosophers. Indeed, the whole, our whole basis, the categories in which our rational mind works are completely modeled on human relationship. If we don't have human relationship as we're growing up, we don't grow up into full human beings. This is basic, but we often miss this. We think we are we have this illusion that we've somehow grown up and figured things out for ourselves, and without this infinite heritage of other people, we would literally be nothing that we would recognize. Nothing. Humans obviously have a very special place in the universe. It's not just our collective narcissism. You can look at our effect on the planet and see that we're doing something nobody else is, for good or bad. We're definitely something unique. But however you define that uniqueness, it's based on the fact that we are animals. And, you know, it's like the, it's like a pyramid. You know, there's the base of the pyramid and it goes to the top, right? And that you could see the base, you know, as our being as animals. You know, the pyramid is always going to have a base. It's part of it. You can't have a pyramid without a base. It doesn't make any sense. This is us, you know. Now, when we die and we have dropped this body, Perhaps that is a completely different mode of existence where we are no longer animals. But we don't have to worry about that right now, because this is where we are. And, you know, we're used in this culture to thinking of this as something to be overcome, you know, and something to be struggled with. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that this is our treasure house, our heritage as primates, as part of nature. You know, there's kind of a natural morality and a cultural morality. You know, there's a natural morality that is based on simply us as what we are given as human beings, and there's also morality that comes from our cultural inheritance. And I think this innate morality, this fitra that Sally Jo mentioned, where we innately recognize the truth, this is an expression of the Divine Mother. This is an expression of nature. This is an expression of what was the line? The soul of nature that gives rise to the universe. We have a tendency to, and it's very hard to define that. You know, it's very difficult to define that because we are caught in our cultural inheritance. So it's very hard for us to say, what is natural morality? Because it changes. It changes in different circumstances. People do try this, they say, what's an, you know, the Dalai Lama's effort to create an ethics for the new millennium is a good example. Our efforts to create global agreements, you know, like the UN Declaration of Human Rights and others that we've talked about. You know, these are attempts to define a universal morality. But they are of their time. They are of our time. And, you know, it's one thing to say we should be kinder to people. We should all develop a compassionate heart. That's a very simple thing, but morality and ethics gets very complicated as soon as you start actually trying to work it out with actual human beings whose idea of compassionate action in the moment might be very different. You know, it's a very different thing to say we should be kinder to each other, or as in the Declaration of Human Rights, we should not torture political prisoners, which is a very complicated thought. And so we're always dealing with the society that we actually have to deal with. And it changes, it really changes. I was reading a book by Gilbert Keith Chesterton lately, kind of a long essay called Utopia of Usurers that was written about 100 years ago. And he's talking about, he's predicting what the future will be like from looking at where he is then. And he's talking about how essentially that capitalism will completely take hold of the culture and be setting our agenda, and that the various ways in which that agenda will control our society. And he's predicting a complete, from his point of view, 100 years ago, a complete dystopian kind of picture. You know, he's like a prophet saying, watch out, if we keep going in this direction, this is what's gonna happen. And sure enough, that's the world we're living in now. But we don't have that point of view. We don't wake up, most of the people do not wake up every morning with a kind of horror at the system they're living with that Chesterton had 100 years ago. Even, you know, our kind of, well, in this area, our sort of typical progressive, what we think of as natural ethics are as culturally determined as, you know, any ethics of anybody, any time and place. Things, you know, in a few decades, we'll probably, if our technological civilization continues, in a few decades, we'll probably be moving into a system of completely digital money. And if that happens, which is very likely, it's a very good bet that governments will start deciding how much money you get and how you can spend it. And which have got many governments are already experimenting with. And it gets even, it'll probably be even worse than that. Not only will the government be deciding how much money you have and how you can spend it, but that decision will very likely be made not by human beings, but by an algorithm. And there will be no recourse. Now, that's a dystopian vision, but it's not even remotely far-fetched. And I guarantee you, if that happens in 100 years, the people who are experiencing that will not be experiencing that as an intolerable tyranny. They'll be experiencing it as just the world they have to deal with. This is just the way things are. So my only point here really is how extremely variable our morality of the moment is. Now, it's probably the morality we need right now. You know, it's the medicine for our sickness. But it's good to realize that there's we can't go too far in thinking that what we think is valuable is universal or permanent. And yet there is this permanent, universal sense of values based on who we are as human beings on the planet relating to each other in a natural way. It's just very hard to pin down because our culture acts like a veil. But it's very helpful. It's, you know, our culture operates in a number of different ways. We have a written culture and we have an unwritten culture. It's much like in the spiritual traditions. You know, in the Jewish tradition, there's a written Torah and there's an unwritten Torah that is written in our hearts and carried on through an oral tradition. It's true in the Orthodox Christian tradition as well. There's scripture, but you can't understand the scripture without tradition, which is the unwritten scripture, which is transmitted from heart to heart, from generation to generation. So we have many guidelines. It's very interesting to me in the Christian and the Jewish readings that we had. You know, the Christian selection says, someone asked Jesus, you know, what's the basis of morality, essentially? And Jesus quotes the Jewish scripture. You know, he quotes the written tradition. It's interesting in contrast that in the Jewish selection that we have, somebody asked Hillel, Rabbi Hillel, you know, what is this, what's morality in a nutshell? And interestingly, the rabbi does not quote scripture. He quotes the golden rule, which is nowhere in the scripture. It's just a natural ethical guideline that we feel in our hearts. It's a rule of thumb in a way. It's a way that we naturally work with each other. And he says, all of the scripture is a commentary on this. He doesn't say it doesn't matter. He says, go study it. But the basis of it is not something that is handed down from on high. The basis of it is something that lives in our hearts. You know, one of the reasons that even the word morality often kind of troubles us and makes us feel as though it's as though we're going to be hit with a stick is much of our morality that is transmitted in our culture is based on this idea of religious revelation that, frankly, most people do not relate to anymore. You know, and this has been going on since ever since the European Enlightenment and the development of humanism and liberalism, etc. Where we have gradually torn down the old models of hierarchy that propped up our thinking about morality. And basically, we don't believe that stuff anymore. And we haven't really managed to replace it with anything else. And this is the real problem we face. You know, the philosopher Nietzsche talked about this over 100 years ago. And I think he was very misunderstood in a lot of what he was saying. He wrote a book called Beyond Good and Evil. And I think people sometimes think he was putting forward the elimination of all values. But really what he was bringing out was what I was just talking about, that we have, that the basis of our values has disappeared. And we're working to develop the next thing. And we aren't quite there yet. And in order to get to the next thing, we've crossed over what Nietzsche calls the abyss of nihilism. You know, where we go through, there's this idea in our culture that all truths are relative, that all values are relative, that there really is no, basis to build this on. We're just kind of making it up as we go along. And I'm suggesting that that's very mistaken. That we deep within us have the foundation that we are looking for. You know, we're primates. Most of our behavior is easily understandable as primate behavior. Most of what we experience, how we relate to each other. We used to think a lot of things about primates that really aren't true. You know, in the 20th century, in 19th and 20th century, we looked at animals, at other animals, through a lens of really projecting our own psychological problems on them. You know, the whole sense of survival of the fittest, and, you know, primate troops being, run by alpha males, whoever was the strongest got all the perks and all this sort of thing. Primate bands don't actually function that way. Yes, there is an alpha male typically, but you know, you only get to be the alpha male if you're supported by the troop. if you're supported by all the females in the troop. The it's a function. It is not where all guidance is coming from, and it's not just like a king of the mountain kind of heap. Primates are practice altruism. You know, if they, you know, they take care of their elders. If they're blind, they lead them around. If they're sick, they bring them water and food. You know, there's social norms, there's culture. You know, children under two, for instance, with chimpanzees, you know, can do anything. You know, they can go up and slap the alpha male on the nose. You know, nobody retaliates against them. If they do, if you do breach the social norms, then you are ostracized or otherwise punished or sanctioned by the whole troop. So this is what we still do, and we have done for hundreds of thousands of years. And I'm not saying there's not, you know, war and infanticide and things like this in primate populations. I'm not saying that they are, you know, that that's that they're living in some kind of utopia, but they are constantly struggling not to conquer each other, but to avoid conflict. You know, this is something we've only really learned in the last few decades from really watching their behavior. They are constantly grooming each other, smoothing things over, making sure agreements happen, mediating with each other. And this is, it's good for us to realize that all of these impulses in us are not unique to us as human beings. They are our inheritance from this deep evolutionary process. I'd like to suggest that morality is less of a legalistic process where we decide what's right and wrong from thinking about, you know, thinking about laws, and really more of a craft for building society. It's we feel our way through our relationships. You know, we feel what fits. We feel what seems right. And it's not really based on legalistic argument. It's based on how it hits us in our hearts. So it's like moving through life and through society is a kind of craft. There's a, this wasn't our Taoist scripture, but there's a beautiful story in the Taoist tradition from Chuangzi, where he's talking about a butcher, and the butcher is telling how he practices his craft of taking apart an animal. And he's saying, you know, when I first started decades ago, you know, I knew how the animal was put together, and I hacked through according to what I knew. And you know, I'd go through a set of knives in about a year. Now, decades later, I move my knife in the spaces between the joints, and they never hit they never hit an obstacle. And now I never have to sharpen my knives. And you know, that's not a question of like increased knowledge. That's a question of developing a craft. And this is how I believe morality works. And this is where we connect with the Divine Mother in our genetic heritage as animals, as primates. We can feel our way through this. We can feel our way into what is right. And it is very often not exactly what we have been taught as such. So the idea, I guess, that I'm promulgating is that, you know, morality, acting in a virtuous manner, is not a matter of following the right rules. It's a matter of our viewpoint, of taking the right viewpoint as we move through society. And I think that the Taoist reading that we have here is very good instruction on this. You know, it says three things. Goodbye. It says three things: wear the undyed and hold the uncarved. In other words, be simple. Stop carving up the world into pieces. Stop setting one part of the world against the other. See it as a whole. Hold to the uncarved. Reduce self-interest and limit desires. It doesn't say desire is bad. It doesn't say stop desiring. It's just saying stop wanting so much all the time. You know, and the third one, get rid of learning and problems will vanish, which I take to mean stop trying to control everything with your mind. Stop trying to get a handle on it and think that you are in control because you have understood it. You know, hold in your mind the infinitude of consequences that you do not see. You know, be humble in your approach. And I think these are beautiful guidelines, and they put us in a place where we can connect with that innate sense of what is right. I would suggest that this is an essentially feminine approach. I think this is, you know, we talk about this succession of prophets, this succession of, and who are almost invariably male prophets in our religious traditions. You know, a huge preponderance of male prophets. And, you know, does this mean that there were no female prophets, or that, you know, of course not. There are as many female prophets in our tradition, in our ancestry, as there are male prophets. They just operate in a different way, have traditionally operated in a different way. Rather than embodying this voice coming off of the mountaintop with a table of laws or a book, they've worked what I'm calling more a way of morality, as a craft, as an art, feeling our way through it from a standpoint of humility and simplicity. And I think this is how women have thus far largely expressed prophethood and prophecy. And it doesn't hit the history books, but it is absolutely as important as anything else. And I think that now this is the way that all of us need to go, because we do not need any more books from the mountaintop. We have enough already. This is not the way things operate. Things operate now through each and every one of us. As we say, we are the ones we have been waiting for. The trust, you know, that Sally Jo was talking about, the amana, the trust that in the Quran, Allah gives to humanity because we accept it. This is not... this is not an addition to us. I believe Sally Jo read the passage where God says, "Am I not your sustainer? And will you witness this?" And we all say yes, and we take on this trust. This does not happen after the creation of humanity. It happens, and this is hard to talk about, it happens before we are created. In other words, it is not something that is given to us, it is something that we are. It is our nature. It is not different from our bodies. It's this innate sense of recognizing the truth is absolutely foundational to everything that we are and everything that we take ourselves to be.